Yeah, thank you. I'm really glad to be speaking here in the mathematical physics seminar. So in my title, I just want to put the emphasis very heavy on the towards, because the whole thing is kind of very much to the beginning and more of a sketch of a research program. And in particular, I'm not even sure to what extent this even applies to QFT, but I hope that in the end you can tell me more about that, because it's in some sense a very naive approach to what a Euclidean QFT is. Correspondingly, this was originally intended actually as just a theory of stochastic processes. So stochastic processes, if you want a Euclidean QFT in 1D, and that is just a lot simpler as far as renormalization and all that stuff is concerned. We don't need to worry about UV so much about what happens in the UV. So I'm not sure to what extent this applies in higher dimensions.
But when you say stochastic
process,
you mean just a one dimensional?
I mean, yes, stochastic process in time, so that's analogous to 1D Euclidean. The same thing as the 1D Euclidean QFT, structurally. So, yeah, oh, yeah, and so this is a joint work with David Spivak at MIT. But let me first say a little what I actually mean by synthetic. So a synthetic theory or a synthetic approach to some particular context is an abstract one where you try to formulate, try to capture the most relevant properties, and then write down axioms or inference rules for those, as opposed to an analytic approach where one looks at more concrete objects and maybe does more like computations with them. So, oh, I forgot to write down for planar geometry. So this is maybe the most obvious, the most basic example. A synthetic approach is given by Euclid's axioms. It just tells you what sort of things you have, points and lines, and what properties and what ways those can relate. Or we can do analytic geometry, and so following Descartes, and use coordinates, right? And then compute everything in coordinates. And this is generally more powerful, because here you can actually say this is more definite. While from the axioms you may not be able to resolve all questions, but it's somewhat easier, nicer to reason in terms of these, right? So yeah, another example maybe for quantum mechanics, we can formulate it very concretely in terms of wave functions, or we can go to a bit more abstract level, look at Hilbert spaces and operators, or even beyond that, just do it completely in terms of C-star algebras. Another example that you may be familiar, some of you may be familiar with, is in homotopy theory. The classical approach to what homotopy theory is in terms of you define topological spaces first, continuous maps, and then homotopies between those, and homotopies between homotopies, and so on. more recently, people have developed a synthetic approach to homotopy theory, namely homotopy type theory, where one reasons in a way that is actually implementable as a programming language on a computer. All these sort of implementation details about what a space is are kind of abstracted away from. All right, so these are just to give some examples of what synthetic versus analytic means. And so this synthetic here is to be understood in roughly a similar sense. So if you write down a particular, let's say, so where I'm sure this stuff applies is if you look at spin glasses, so things where the UV is unproblematic, like, well, because then space is discrete. So then you write down a concrete Hamiltonian as on that lattice of spins, and a corresponding Gibbs measure, and so this I would consider classify as analytic relative to the synthetic thing that I want to outline.
When you consider topological
DQFTs,
is that an example of synthetic?
I would categorize that also as analytic. Yeah. Although, so what I'm doing here assumes kind of we look at a fixed kind of space-time where at least in a mathematician's definition of TQFT, one has all sorts of manifolds at the same time. So here I want to fix space or space-time. All right, so the first part that I want to talk about is the logic of space. So this is the synthetic aspect that is not yet concerned with or concerned with purely the kinematics, if you want. So there's no probabilities yet. I'm going to build those on top later on. And so I'm going to motivate this by kind of some toy examples. So, or just as a motivating question, sort of a toy question. If we look at a particular phrase, proposition or sentence that refers to space in some sense, then I want to ask, what is the truth value of that proposition? So for example, what is the truth value of, so my toy question would be, is it raining? So now what is the truth value of the answer? Well, the answer cannot just be yes or no. As we might normally think, because the answer depends on where we are in space, well, in space-time. So, the truth value really should be a function from space-time to, let's say, the Booleans. So it should be a function. Space-time to, so I'm going to denote the truth, Boolean truth values by these, so false and true. Or equivalently, well, instead of specifying such a function, it's enough to say where the function takes value true, and so then we'll interpret this as the indicator function of a subset. Right, so equivalently a subset. Okay, so let me illustrate this. So this is supposed to be space-time now, and here's the rain. So now the truth value of this proposition, we would identify it with, well, this interval. But now the question arises, do we take the closed or the open interval? And well, the convention that turns out to be useful for the logic that is going to follow is that we take the open interval. So here the answer is clearly yes. Here the answer is clearly no. And here we're not sure. So we also declare it to be no because we're not sure, roughly. So this is sort of a qualified no. Okay. And yeah, so that means we take the open sets as truth values. And I should say that this is, well, I guess many of you will already know this, but this is far from new. So this is heading to intuitionistic logic and topos theory and Kripke-Scheuerl semantics. So take the open sets to be the truth values. So then we can sort of set up a dictionary between topology and logic. How about logical connectors? How do we interpret these in terms of open sets? And this is pretty simple, except perhaps for implication. So containment, let me do this last. So the union corresponds, well, to this junction, which should be pretty clear. The intersection corresponds to a conjunction. The empty set corresponds to false, the whole space. X corresponds to true, whole space. And finally, and the trickiest one of these is containment, corresponds to implication. But here we have to be a little bit careful in that we want the implication again to be an open. So this we would now interpret as a Boolean truth value when I plug into opens here. But that's what we want to do. We want all truth values again to live in this logic. So we need to define implication of two open sets again to be an open set. And we just define it to be the largest open set where the usual implication holds. So this is basically the definition. So this is a big or equivalently a big union of opens to be the overall W's for which the implication holds. And the implication holds in W means that if we intersect U with W, then we get a subset of V. So this is called a Hating implication then in this case. And so we can also identify this with the interior of, so classically, we would think that the implication holds at a subset which is given by V. Well, inside of V, it should definitely hold. And also at X without U, so whenever U does not hold, we would expect it to hold. So this is an implication is true if and only if the consequent is true or the antecedent is false. We can basically also write down this. But now we still need to take the interior in order to make this, again, live in our set of truth values. All right. So for example, in R, we can take the interval from 0 to 2, the open interval, and the open interval from 1 to 3. And now the implication is going to be consist of, well, as soon as we're below 0, we're good. The implication holds. And as soon as we're above 1, the implication holds as well. So then it would be this. OK, as a special case, we have negation. Not U, well, by definition, is U implies false. So this is again going to be an open set. And well, semantically or in terms of the space, it's just the interior of the complement. OK, and now given this, the interior of the complement, we can see that a law of excluded middle does not typically hold. So generally, we have U. Or not U is not equal to true. So, and we can also nicely illustrate this in terms of this picture again. If this is our U, then not U would be the open set going to up to this point, and the union of the half open interval starting here, and hence the union does not contain these two points. So the union, but the union is still dense, and this is also generic, but yeah. A similar thing is that double negation, we can take double negation of U. This will also not be equal to U in general. But so which things do still hold? And basically the idea is that everything that you can do constructively, where I don't want to go into the details exactly of what that means. But anything that you could write down as a function in a computer program, in a functional programming language, for example, would work. let me put this in quotes. I can make it more precise if anyone wants. But so all other basic inference rules are still valid. So the basic ones. So except for excluded middle, law of excluded middle are still valid. So for example, we have modus ponens. So if U implies V and V implies W, then U implies W. You can interpret this as saying for any three opens, this expression defines a new open, which is always going to be the whole space. This is basically what this means now semantically. Okay. All right, so far this was just propositional logic. But how about, well, in order to do any sort of non-trivial mathematics, yeah?
Oh.
Okay, I thought you had.
I did have a question.
Yeah, okay.
You've described this, this is a very general, maybe we shouldn't get off into too much, but you described this as a space of truth values.
Yeah.
But it looks to me a lot more natural, or at least it looks as if when I listen to it, you're talking about the spaces of propositions themselves. So do you have
right.
a separate space of propositions?
No.
Do you have some
no. Right, yeah, yeah. I'm using those two terms pretty much synonymously. So
okay.
propositions for the purposes of this can be identified with truth values. And any two propositions, so which are so this is any two propositions which are derivable from each other are considered equal. This is, yeah. Okay, so this was propositional logic, but in order to do any sort of non-trivial mathematics, we obviously also want quantifiers. So I don't want to say all that much about that. Except that quantifiers work pretty much as usual. Except in that we're a little bit more restricted into what sort of inference rules and axioms we're allowed to use. So mainly we're not allowed to use the axiom of choice. So these are the main two things and that distinguish it from classical usual reasoning, that but without choice. All right, and so now my main point here is that if we reason in terms of this logic from the sort of internal perspective, we don't know that this logic is describing things that vary in space internally. So we're just using usual inference rules. Here we can pretend, as soon as we're limited to these rules, we can pretend that this is these are any sort of truth values. And the sets, when you reason in terms of quantifiers, well, quantifiers range over sets or over some kind of object. And then these objects become sort of themselves objects that vary in space. So technically, I mean, sheaves, right? So this is sheaf semantics. Sets become sheaves. So we can reason about sheaves and open sets and the corresponding base space as if they were sets. We sort of no longer need to remember that these things vary in space. And this is kind of the whole point and why this is interesting, why this is cool.
Building quantifiers by producing sheaves.
No, I mean,
these
are two separate things. Yeah, yeah. Quantifiers basically, yeah, as I said, work as usual, so satisfy the standard inference rules. But what you quantify over the thing that looks from the point of view of the logic looks like a set is semantically actually describes a sheaf. So we can do things like, yeah, let me give an example. In this sheaf semantics, if we have an object capital X, which internally looks like a set, we can write down the statement that there exists, or maybe I should use element instead of types notation, there exists an element little x in X. So here we might think that, well, now if X is a sheaf, so this roughly looks like it's stating that there exists a global section. This is actually not exactly what it says, but this is saying that around every point there is a local section, so at every point there's a germ. So this is a statement about a sheaf X. Also, from the perspective of this first order logic, this first order logic does not know this, that this is a sheaf. So far, there's no way to talk about, to even talk about anything else, or to distinguish it from something else. Does that clarify things a little?
Are you saying it's always a sheaf?
Yes. Every object within this logic is necessarily a sheaf.
No, I mean, it's the only sort of model of this whole sheaf.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's a good question. Technically, no. So there are other models as well. Other models, for example, called effective topos that describes computation, other kinds of models as well. So they're not necessarily sheaves. But under very mild additional assumptions on the corresponding categories, there are categories of sheaves. So this is basically topos theory from a bit of a particular perspective, from the perspective of this internal logic, which not everyone uses. All right, so now suppose that we want to do some kind of physics with this. We want to talk about fields. Then this is good. We can talk about sections of sheaves, or sheaves and their sections. But these are more like bundles with discrete fibers, right? So et al bundles. But when working with bundles and fields, we usually want to have, non-discrete fibers. So how do we build this in? So how about bundles with non-discrete fibers? Here is just a scalar field. And so just like a sheaf is something like behaves like a set that varies in space, what we would like to have here is, at least in first approximation, a topological space that varies itself in space. And maybe you want to have also some additional smooth structure and other stuff on top of that. But for now, I'll just stick with the topology because, well, I've kind of been doing topology all the way along, so this is what I can do at the moment. Again, this is not really new. And the right definition of what one can use here turns out to be exactly the usual definition of a topological space. But now it's just formulated within this logic. So let me write it down, and then I can try to explain it a little more. So this is just the definition that you all know. Yes, an object X. Together with a subset or sub object, we call it curly T in prop to the X. So this is now my set, or actually it's a sheaf of, internally also a sheaf of prepositions or truth values. And so just like classically, we would take a topology would be a subset of the power set. Now in this logic, the role of the power set is played by this thing. There is, in the category, an exponential object like this, which is the object of all functions from x to prop. So it plays the role of the power set. Okay, such that a bunch of things hold. So first of all, the empty sub-object and the whole thing should be elements of this. The exact usual conditions, T is closed under binary intersections. And closed under arbitrary unions. So this makes perfect sense in this logic, and what I want to argue is that this is now a good notion of bundle with non-discrete fibers.
Subobject T, subset of what does that say?
This is prop to the X. So this plays the role of the power set of X. Prop is this set or sheaf or object of all prepositions. Yep. So this makes sense not only externally as a set, but also within the logic itself. We can talk about this thing, which is kind of an extra assumption that I haven't really made explicit, but. Okay, and so now in terms of, well, we would like to know what this means. What is the semantics of this? What sort of extra structure? So X is a sheaf, and if we have this sort of thing, what extra structure on the sheaf does that correspond to from the external perspective? And this was answered by Mordek in 84. And so the result is that internal spaces, there's a category of these. Internal spaces in that sense, this category is equivalent to the category of bundles. This is in, takes place in this, in the topos of sheaves on the topological space S, and I'm writing here S to suggest that this stands for space or space-time on which we want to put the Euclidean QFT. And so he proved that this category of internal spaces is equivalent to the category of bundles over S. So where X actually carries two topologies. So let me denote them T1 and T2. Now these are external. These are just on the set X, such that if we take T1, this is what makes it into a sheaf. So this is an Atal space. And T2 should be a coarser topology, which now has something like none. I mean, this has discrete fibers. And the other topology is not discrete, does not necessarily have discrete fibers anymore. And so the requirement is it should be a coarser topology, but still fine enough such that this projection map is still continuous.
Okay,
Okay, well, this is kind of technical, I guess. But just to illustrate that this notion of internal space also has a reasonably nice external characterization or semantics. And the one that we'd be interested in the case of some kind of field theory with non-discrete fibers is this one, the T2, right? Okay, so now let me switch gears. So this was what I wanted to say about the logic, to have some kind of basic setup, not to build probability theory on top of this. So is this more or less clear so far, or? Yeah?
I suppose we're just doing ordinary topology, not this fancy version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like having S to be a one-point space?
Yes, exactly.
It's just a topological space.
Yes, that's exactly right, yeah. Well, whenever we take S to be just a one-point space, then sheaves in S is just a category of sets again. And so then there, everything has the usual meaning. Although, well, we still don't have the axiom of choice in the law of excluded middle to reason in that, because our logic is general enough to work for all S. Oh, I forgot to say one thing. No, I'll do that later, actually. Yes, okay. So now I want to say something about building in probability theory. Oh, and I should say, what sort of the main idea is. Maybe I should have done this earlier. So the main idea is that, well, a probability space, we have a set with a probability measure on it, or with sigma algebra or something, and a probability measure on it. And in Euclidean QFT, we also have probability measures, at least roughly speaking, morally speaking, probability measures on sections of sheaves, right? Or on sections of a sheaf. And so now the idea is that we want to try and write down the usual definition of what a probability space is in this logic in such a way that its semantics will turn out to be precisely that of the Euclidean QFT. That's the idea. That just like the definition of this, if we write this down internally, it corresponds to something like a topological space that varies over X. We're hoping that if we write down the definition of probability space in a suitable topos of sheaves, it will become equivalent to compatible families of probability measures on spaces of sections. Yeah, I'll get to the details. So let me first talk about probability theory.
Can I ask, why do you say sheaf? When you're doing the quantum field theory,
yeah,
is it because you're thinking of a scalar field as a section of a certain?
Exactly. Yes. Just the general notion of a field that I have in mind is that it's a section of a certain.
Does it cover? Maybe it's getting too far away, but what about gauge fields? They're not exactly sections. They're connections on bundles.
Right, but there's still a bundle of.
There's a sheaf is bounded, yeah. And it follows the space of connections on that ball.
There's still a sheaf of connections on a bundle, on a principal bundle, for example. So I mean, the concept of sheaves is just anything forms a sheaf that has a kind of local. Whenever you have any concept that has a sort of local character, then you get it forms a sheaf. You need to be able to restrict it. You can restrict a connection that is defined on an open set. You can restrict it to an open subset. And then you have a bunch of connections on some open sets which are compatible, which look the same on the intersections, and you can glue them. This is all that you need in order to get a sheaf.
So a connection is a section of some sheaf.
Yes.
Some sort of a sheaf.
Sheaves are more general than sections.
So if you have a probability space internal to some topos of sheaves, presumably the probabilities for this probability space are going to take values and functions on the base.
Yes, that's right.
Which is not how I normally think of.
I'll get to that. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And the first attempt is also going to go wrong, but. Okay.
The title is Twerks.
That's true.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, the way that I want to think about probability theory is that it assigns probabilities, meaning numbers, to propositions, or more generally to predicates. So the thing that it assigns probabilities to should itself be something logical. And this is, I want to sort of take as a hand-wavy motivation for saying that the notion of probability measure that I want to use is one which is only defined on open sets. It's not defined in a sigma algebra, but only on opens. So now this is, for the moment, this is classical again. This is not in the internal logic, just to simplify. Also, you can already think of it in those terms if you want, but for now, it's okay to think of this in ordinary classical logic. So a continuous probability evaluation. And here, valuation is a term that is more or less the analog of measure. It's just a different, I'll say something about the correspondence, the exact correspondence of measures after this. So computer scientists study this thing quite a bit for programming semantics and stuff like that. So we have, so now I'm changing my notation to O of X for the set of opens of a space X. So now this is a map mu from the opens into the reals such that false or the empty set has probability 0 and the whole thing has probability 1. And it should be monotone. If we look at a larger set, then the amount or the probability or the weight can only increase. And it should satisfy a version of, so this is called the inclusion-exclusion relation. Now I'm kind of switching back and forth between the topology and the logic notation, so let me stick to be consistent with the logic notation. Implies means just a subset of. The inclusion-exclusion relation and finally, the thing that makes it continuous. So far, this looks like a lot like a finitely additive measure. So, but we want something that corresponds to sigma additivity. So this is Scott continuity. So this says for any directed family of opens, if we look at the union, then the measure of that is well approximated by the measure of the individual ones, meaning that it's the supremum. So this, roughly speaking, in some sense, plays the role of sigma additivity, except this is not restricted to countable families, but to arbitrary directed families. And this is part of what makes it more well-behaved in this constructive or setting of intuitionistic logic.
You didn't use the word probability measure. Is that on purpose?
Yes, that's on purpose because this is a sort of different concept, not defined in a sigma algebra, only defined on the opens and satisfying slightly different properties.
Then in the standard set, if this S has one point set, you recover precisely the definition of probability measure?
Right, this is what I was going to go to next. There's this theorem due to Alvarez Mania, 2003. If the space X is regular, which is a certain separation condition that every point in every closed set can be separated by disjoint open neighborhoods, then the continuous probability valuations on X, or an O of X, well, there's a bit of an ambiguity of do we say that mu lives in X or an O of X? I'm not sure. So these are in bijection with certain kinds of probability measures, as John was asking. And where certain kinds means that kind of well-behaved probability measures, namely, these are predetectable conditions, regular, tau smooth, probability measures on X, Borel probability measures on X. All right, so this is very general. And actually, sort of morally or philosophically speaking, I'm personally not quite sure which one I would like to consider as the better definition of what a probability measure, what a probability space should be. But for now,
if it means directly into this, there's some version of some type of space where that said you had finally added measures until that last step.
Yeah.
So is there some version of this story that also?
What do you mean by means? As an amenability or?
So I mean it's like a measure that's only finally added.
Well, I'm not. Yeah.
Is there some type of a space where that last axiom doesn't constrain you further?
You mean where it automatically holds? No.
Maybe I'll ask you later.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what I want to take as the definition of probability space is the thing on the left. A space X together with a continuous probability evaluation. Okay, so now, yeah, the idea is to take this very same definition and interpret it internally in the topos, so in the intuitionistic logic. And then, so in the category of sheaves on our space or spacetime X, S, sorry. So, but in order to do that, we first need to say where it's supposed to take values. Here we have the real numbers, and the real numbers are in some sense a pretty complicated object. So what do we do with this? What is this going to be in our logic? We first need to define it. And it turns out that there are several inequivalent definitions of what a real number is in the internal logic. So classically, you can take Dedekind cuts as the definition, Cauchy sequences of rational numbers, and prove that these are equivalent. In the topos case, more generally, for sheaves on S, there are, in general, several inequivalent definitions. And there's a good reason for why they're inequivalent, because they have different semantics. So let me sketch the definition of one of them, at least. And this involves, again, we basically need to start with the rationals and define a real number in terms of rational numbers. So this is still the same. So the rational numbers are defined as usual, basically, in terms of the integers in terms of the natural numbers, and the natural numbers are assumed to be given and basically uniquely characterized by induction and recursion. So this gives us the rational numbers to work with. Semantically, these correspond to just the constant sheaf taking values in the rational numbers. So a lower cut is a sub-object of Q such that satisfying a bunch of conditions. So namely, it should be a down set. A is in L and B is less than A, so these are rational numbers. Then B is in L as well. And let me just recall, this is all taking place now in this internal logic. So in particular, what this, for example, sub-object means is that if we think of Q as a sheaf having these local sections, then the sub-objects may contain, for example, it may not contain some particular local section, but it may contain a restriction of that local section to a smaller sub-open. So there's a sort of, for a particular section, the amount by which it is contained in L can itself be a non-trivial truth value, which is, so it turns out to be itself an open set. This is roughly how this works. And again, all these conditions are formulated in the internal logic. Okay, and what I'm trying to do here is to, a lower cut is supposed to be something like the set of all lower bounds, the set of all rationals that are less than the given real number that it specifies. So then this condition is obvious. A set of lower bounds is down closed. And also the set of lower bounds is what's called rounded. If A is in L, then there is just another rational that is just slightly larger than A with B and L as well, because L is supposed to represent the open interval up to the real number that it's characterizing. And finally, there should be some lower bound on what our number is, otherwise we're including allowing minus infinity. Okay, and so now the lower reals are lower bar, or underline, are just defined as the set of all lower cuts, or the object of all lower cuts. So this still makes sense internally. And again, if you work out what this means externally, what the semantics of this is, this turns out to be lower semi-continuous functions on R space S. So this is a sheaf, and its local sections are precisely the lower semi-continuous functions taking values in the ordinary reals, the external reals, on every open subset. Okay, we can do a similar construction where we also include not just lower cuts, but also upper cuts, and do some kind of Dedekind thing where we go from both sides at the same time. And then the semantics turn out to be not the lower semi-continuous functions, but the sheaf of continuous functions on S. And given that these are different, generally, this motivates why there should be different notions of real number in this setting. Okay, so now we can define what a probability space is, internal probability space. Well, it's an internal space. Together with a continuous probability evaluation. And now I'm using this definition again, but now interpreted internally, taking the lower reals here. And there's also a good reason for why I want the lower reals here, not the Dedekind reals or some other one.
So a section of lower reals is like a lower semi-continuous function, is that?
Yes, right. So it can basically only jump down at together with a continuous probability evaluation mu from the internal object of opens to these lower reals. The idea of taking the lower reals is roughly speaking that the probability should be simple to bound from below, but I don't want to expect them to, that it's also possible to find simple upper bounds. All right, so now what do we expect this to be semantically? Is this something like Does this equip our spaces of sections now from the external perspective with something like probability measures, which we would want for Euclidean QFT? And the answer is no. And so the reason is that here, let me take a particular example, where suppose our space or space-time S is discrete, and maybe even just finitely many points, if you like. So then the semantics of X and OX is something like a family of topological spaces. So this bracket stands for semantics of, roughly. So this is a family of spaces. So X, S, O of X, S, indexed by the individual points or elements of our set, capital S. And now if you look at mu, or this our underline, it's going to be tuples of real numbers indexed by S. So now if you look at this sort of thing, what this is going to be is that it will equip each one of these spaces with a continuous probability evaluation. So this is not intended to be really precise, but just morally speaking, to see why this does not work, why this does not give a Euclidean QFT, is internal probability space, the semantics of that, is going to be family of internal probability spaces. So there are no correlations. We don't know what happens at the individual points. We do not have a sort of joint distribution for the individual things, for the individual field operators, if you want. So this is family of probability spaces. And the point is that this is not what we want.
Space-time or something
like that?
Space-time
isn't discrete. No. I just wanted to illustrate it. Even in this case, we got the wrong thing. In a discrete case, what we would expect to get is something like that there is at least a joint distribution or a probability measure on sections of our sheaf, right?
I mean, I would imagine writing down, like, I have a hard time imagining that. If I have a discrete space-time and some field on it,
then
at least in high energy field theory, I would want to write down some local Lagrangian, local action function.
Yeah.
My space-time's discrete.
Yeah. You want to be able to talk about correlation functions that involve points that are arbitrarily far, pairs of points that are arbitrarily far.
Everything factors.
Like that, discrete space-time. You can write a scalar field theory on a closed set.
Just take the Ising model on a lattice.
But that's not a discrete space-time. The Ising model, like lattice models, very explicitly have interactions between the nearest neighbors.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a discrete But I don't. I mean.
No. The underlying space is discrete. No, there's no topology. There's no non-trivial topology on the space.
The Ising model does not satisfy the axioms of a local point of view.
Right.
I think that's the point. If you take whatever local point of view theory is on a discrete set,
uh-huh.
There will be no correlation between.
Right. Yeah. I think we have different notions of what discrete means. I just mean.
You might be saying.
Discrete as a topological space.
That's what I mean too. Take local point of view on like. Set of 2 points.
Yeah.
It is not possible to have correlations between those 2 points.
Not for a local quantum field theory. I mean, absolutely, you can.
Okay, you have a different notion of local. Yeah. That's fine. Yeah, sure.
If you remove this notion of local, then any mention of your
Yeah. So then it sounds like you would consider the Ising model also non-local?
The Ising model is non-local. The Ising model has like the space-time has some sort of thing-like
right,
topology.
Right.
The fact that there's notions of neighborhood and distances between the points. Metrics are very similar to topologies.
Mm-hmm.
The interaction has some locality property because it's
the
nearest neighbor.
Yeah.
What did you say about finite topology?
I mean, the only reason for why...
There are interesting finite topological spaces which are not discrete.
You don't call them discrete. But I think that Tobias has called them...
Discrete means the discrete topology. S, he said, was the discrete topology. He didn't say S was finite. He said S was discrete. There's not very much topology you can do.
There's a linguistic...
No, it's not. There's like, there's a word, discrete, and has a meaning. We can't change it.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying. I'm certainly not trying to change it.
So, I mean, I'm trying to say you got exactly as close to a correct answer as it's possible to get. You have a set for your space.
Okay, but so then let me say that if I haven't worked out what this means in what the semantics of being a non-discrete case, but I don't think that it will give you anything
that's
substantially different.
True, but this wasn't counterexample.
But also, I mean, I would like to be able to capture the Ising model as well.
Sure.
So then this fails the test. So yeah,
For Ising model's not a discrete set.
Yes, it is discrete as a topological space, and your field theory is non-local. I mean, the notion for why I need a topology is only to be able to talk about sheaves on that space. It's not about talking about. It's not relevant for the interactions.
Other than a discriminant of words?
It has nothing to do with interactions. I just want to capture, I'm not even talking about dynamics here, I'm just talking about kinematical things.
So, I mean, the disagreement is that he was saying this is a counterexample. We think this is the expected behavior of a local quantum field in a discrete set.
And if you asked me to write down the Ising model, I would tell you that this sort of the set of the space-time might be all of the sites in the lattice, and I would topologize it in such a way that the edges are not closed points.
Well, the edges are. I wouldn't put field operators on the edges, only on the vertices, and then the space-time only consists on the. But okay, I guess we both agree that this
that you have not described the Ising model.
Yeah, good, all right. And that looking at these internal probability spaces and sheaves on S is not what we want to do for Euclidean QFT. That was my whole point. I didn't want to, yeah. All right, I guess I should be wrapping up. So the sort of conjectural solution, and we've actually made good progress in improving this, improving at least the parts of it, the part of it that works purely internally. Is to change the topos. Instead of working with sheaves on S, we also work with sheaves on the hyperspace of S, which is the space of compact subsets of S. I can briefly try to motivate this. So the idea being that we also want to talk about, for example, we want to talk about correlation functions, which are necessarily non-local observables.
So is this going to be something like the Rand space used by Bill Sinterfeld?
The what?
Are you familiar with the Rand space? It's the set of finite compact subsets of...
I've heard the term, but it's finite what, compact or convex?
Compact, of course, but finite subsets of a topological space.
Oh, no.
They define quantum field theory in terms of sheaves on the Rand space.
Ah, that's interesting to know. Okay, I should check that out, yes. Uh-huh, Balanz and Drinfeld.
Yes.
Yes, okay, thanks, yeah. So we're working with the compact subsets.
But it will include that too.
Also, there are some, they do that.
So it will include the Rand space, presumably.
Yeah, sure, yes, right. Also, and there's some flexibility in there, it seems. So potentially, I mean, we could try to do the same thing with finite subsets only. But I need to check that. Thanks. Yeah. Do they do that for, I mean, Euclidean or Lorentzian?
Well, they're focused
quantum.
On chiral algebras.
Yeah.
Algebra geometry setting.
Okay.
But there's a lot of literature on this, this language for topological field theory.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah, good to know. Yeah.
And it's pretty close to what Owen and I do in Euclidean.
All right, yeah. I'll read up on that and maybe get back to you. If,
Naively, I would think that maybe I do want to work with compact sets so that I can have sort of like higher co-dimension operators.
That makes sense. It just gets very messy when you all collide and stuff, right? It's a big disaster.
Okay, so let me just write down what the sort of conjecture is. And we're working towards the proof, which is actually quite a lot of work and very, technically much more demanding than I had thought. So internal probability spaces in sheaves on CS correspond to compatible families of continuous probability evaluations. And now my main question for you would be if this is even a reasonable definition of Euclidean QFT. But let me write it down first, and then I'm.
CS, set of all compact.
Set of, yeah, I guess I'm too short in time to go into the details, but a set, a space, the space of all compact subsets of S, equipped with a certain topology that makes compact subsets that are kind of close also become close in this space. So it's called the upper topology. It has very bad separation properties also. Okay, so compatible families of continuous probability evaluations on spaces, or more like sets of sections. So this is compatible family here means that for every compact subset, I have a probability measure in a space of sections, and these should be compatible if I go from a larger compact set to a smaller one. But basically, my main question would be if you look at renormalization and things like that, what happens in the UV, I'm personally no longer sure just because of my own ignorance. If it's still meaningful to define that a Euclidean QFT would be something like a probability measure or continuous probability evaluation on a space of sections.
Do these axioms work for the one-dimensional case, like bounding in motion?
Yeah, it's still, so we think so, but we haven't proven it yet. And what goes into the proof is never anything about the dimension. We never even used that a space system, space-time is a manifold. It seems to work for pretty much any topological space.
This is a more concrete question. Right? You have Brownian motion, measure on some space.
We don't know yet.
Does that fit in this?
Yeah, it does not seem to be any simpler in the completely general case. So is it reasonable that a Euclidean QFT still assigns a probability measure, where perhaps in this modified sense, to?
My feeling is, my intuition will tell me that probably every quantum field theory that I would want to admit you can kind of encode in this way, but that you've either prescribed the notion of quantum field theory.
What do you mean by prescribed?
That probably there's I know lots of other examples like this where people write down some axioms and they say, all of my quantum field theory satisfy these axioms. And I'm like, that sounds great, except that there are things that satisfy the axioms that don't sort of deserve the name quantum field theory as well.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, of course. I mean, locality and all that, I'm not even starting to talk about that. Yeah. I'm more worried about the other inclusion. So I primarily would like all Euclidean QFTs at least to fit this pattern. And that you seem to be saying is likely true.
I mean, would you have like a measure space for every open? Is that literally what you're going to find? I got a bit lost on that.
More like for every compact set.
For every compact set, you have a measure space.
We have a space of sections.
Yes.
Equipped with a certain topology as well.
Yes.
Then to have a certain kind of measure maybe defined in the sense of continuous probability evaluation, but I don't think the details matter much.
So my
I measure on the space of sections.
My concern with that, right? Suppose we take like the Gaussian free field.
Yeah.
So in this case, there's no difficulties writing down the measure and so on.
Okay.
But if I was to try to write down the measure on the space of, like if I take a compact manifold, there is a measure which deserves to be called the free field measure on the space of distributions on that manifold.
Yeah.
And you probably know that the locus of continuous functions is a measure zero, so this is very nasty.
Yeah. Oh.
Except in dimension one. When it's a port of continuous functions.
Oh, right. I see.
If you get higher dimension, the regularity gets worse.
Really, it's supported and non-continuous.
Yes.
Okay, I only knew about the dimension one case.
Yes. You about the case you pre-feel this. Mm-hmm. But in any case, my concern is if I took a non-compact region, I would have to worry about to get the measure, I would have to impose some boundary conditions.
Yes. Yes. Right.
I might be messing up the sheet of nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be my concern.
Yeah. The restriction. Mm-hmm. That's a right. That's a very good point. Yeah, that I'm not sure about at the moment.
I mean, I was about to say something. I think it's
this is the quantum field theory together with what you might call a choice of vacuum. But that choice of vacuum can then take the place of your boundary conditions and the compact.
Yeah, yeah, and then the things restrict nicely. Right, yeah, thanks. Yeah. All right, well, I guess I should stop here. And thanks.
Any questions?
Is that a comment for anyone who really understands?
You raised the question of renormalization.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe someone can comment on what I'm about to say, whether it sounds right or not. I mean, it seems to me, except in free field theories, people don't even know whether it can, well, maybe they do in lower dimensions, have some examples, whether there is actually well-defined continuum limit of theory.
Yeah.
So it's often described by a sort of family of theories associated with different length scales. And you have to take some sort of limit in the question.
Sure.
Each one of those separate ones would fit, I think, into your framework.
Yeah. No, my question was more like, after you've renormalized, would it still fit?
But is there when you actually take the continuum limit?
Yes.
Yeah. What is the history space?
Even if there is no precise definition, would we expect it to fit?
Well, there. I think that people do have precise.
Or candidate definitions.
In two space-time dimensions.
Yeah.
For example, and the question is, does it fit?
I mean, I think we get answering it for the free field would be a good start. Answering the question for the free field is a good start.
Yeah.
But yeah, but given that they have this
work. Oh, and one more thing to say is that.
I don't know. Thing you're talking about.
I don't know. It's axioms. Yeah. I mean, the measure exists, but I don't know if it fits these axioms.
It may not be a probability measure. There's a probability measure in the normal
sense. It is, but this is a very elaborate system.
Don't they include
Won't they admit? Won't a probability measure in the normal sense satisfy all your axioms?
If it's suitably well behaved, so if it's this regular tau smooth, then yes.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I don't know what. Yeah. Yeah, what is that? I see. That's what you're worried about.
One thing that I can still maybe say in favor or is positive evidence of this. I said, in some sense, this approach is kind of dual to AQFT. So in AQFT, we have these nets of observables, right, for every region. And then, well, the inclusion maps kind of go the other way, right? So here, it's restriction maps. But it's conceptually the same thing because of, I think, in terms of Galfoyan duality. So also in AQFT, we sort of have the net of observables. This sort of a pre-sheaf taking values in C-star algebras op. So it's a similar flavor.
T is explicitly only Lorentzian.
Yes, sure. Yeah, yeah. Modulo that, and then to get non-commutativity and the causality condition and all that. Yeah, sure. Yes.
You get the
Yeah. It's only supposed to be a sort of little.
I think it fits much better with this kind of factorization algebra built in the flow picture.
Mm.
They would say you get a sheaf, the sheaf of observables on the space of compact sets.
Yeah.
And it has some properties corresponding to what happens when I take disjoint unions of compacts.
So does that mean observables are necessarily local things?
Well, if I take the stock at a particular compact set, that's what I measurements I can do on that set.
Oh, you're also on the hyperspace.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right. Yeah.
And then the category of sheaves on the hyperspace has a partially defined monoidal structure given by disjoint union.
What?
It has a partially defined monoidal structure given by disjoint union.
Yeah.
And it's an algebra with respect to that.
Yeah.
That's what they that's what they use.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I have to, and then you mean maybe one can express locality properties better, or what is the advantage of doing it like that?
Oh,
if you can very briefly, maybe.
I mean, the advantage is it's known in many examples to be. You can start an example that fits with the known axiom, then Lorentzian signal. It is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Oh, sure. Let's thank the speaker again.